several miles off the main highway, tucked away in a secluded canyon on prime vineyard property, stands a rustic barn that was built many decades before the vines around it were planted. In that barn, a sophisticated broadcast and recording studio has been built. The barn also has a well-hidden root cellar stocked with many of the world's most exceptional wines, only to be shared with guests who secretly come to offer their insights and tell their stories. Guests are sworn to secrecy and are shuttled to the studio aboard a John Deere tractor. Those who cannot make the journey in person are interviewed by satellite hookup, and sometimes the crew simply sneaks away with microphones in hand and interviews guests in barrel rooms, wine cellars, and other magical places. All of this is done like clockwork every single week, so that we can bring you another episode of Grape Encounters Radio.
Peel me a grape, crush me some ice, skin me a peach, save the fuzz for my pillow.
And it is time for your weekly Grape Encounter, and I guess there's no hiding the fact that I can sometimes be a little unkind when it comes to restaurant wine lists. And so when I saw a story this week about a restaurant in Charlottesville, Virginia, that is doing something that I think is long overdue, actually doing a number of things that I think is long overdue, I had to get the owner on the line. It's Justin Ross. The restaurant is Parallel 38. Hey, Justin, welcome to Grape Encounters.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Hey, listen, so you're not just a chef, you're also a sommelier as well.
Correct.
So let's talk about the restaurant. First of all, the restaurant is called Parallel 38 because?
Just because if you look around the globe, it passes through some of the most renowned food and wine areas in the world. It also passes through Napa Valley, Sonoma, Italy, Spain, and of course, Charlottesville, Virginia, where we're located.
That's quite a coincidence, or maybe it's not. I didn't imagine Charlottesville to be on the same parallel as the Napa Valley, but lo and behold, it is. Charlottesville has become an eating town, hasn't it?
It definitely has. It's a town that definitely prides itself in the amount of quote-unquote foodies it has. I believe there's over 700 restaurants for a town of its size. It's pretty incredible.
700 restaurants?
Yes.
Wow, and Charlottesville used to be a sleepy little town. Wow.
Correct, yeah.
Amazing. So how long have you been in business there?
Our one-year anniversary will actually be this New Year's Day.
Oh, awesome. Fantastic. All right, so first thing I wanted to do was talk about what reservations perhaps that you have had with wine lists over the past that caused you to kind of rethink the restaurant wine list equation.
Well, I've worked at pretty much every kind of place imaginable, anywhere from a 27,000 bottle wine cellar where we had 17,000 wow. different wines to ones where we just carry 80 boutique sort of style wines. And as much as I like the learning experience of having the 27,000 different bottles, it was daunting to say the least for inventory purposes, but also a bit intimidating for people that just weren't into wine or trying to get into wine. And I guess I really wanted to make wine super approachable so people could enjoy anything.
And I think going into a restaurant is probably the single most intimidating place to buy wine because you're sitting there with people that oftentimes you want to impress, you've got a date or whatever, and they hand you a book. And, you know, more often than not, most of the wines you're not going to be familiar with, and the ones that you are going to be familiar with are going to be the ones that the distributor has kind of thrust upon the restaurants, and they're not typically that good.
You know, I agree with that. People do come in, and no one wants to feel stupid or feel like they don't understand what's going on when they're ordering wine or food for that matter, but it's one of the few places as well that when you sell something, the consumer is actually consuming it in front of you.
Yes,
so you want to
exactly
make sure that they are comfortable with the purchase when they get it. Otherwise, they're not going to like it. You're going to know about it the second they don't like it.
So tell us what you did and how you approached the wine list at Parallel 38. What did you think needed to be changed, and what did you do to change it?
The thing that we're known for the most of all is that we have about 120 wines by the glass.
120 wines by the glass?
Yeah, so aside from three of our sparklings, every single bottle that we have, we offer by the glass as well.
I don't think I've ever heard of that in my entire life. And are you using a Coravin or something to accomplish that?
We are. You know, we don't Coravin every single wine, but it's split into sort of groups of these wines ready to fly off the shelves. We open those if we know we're going to go through a bottle in a night, and then we Coravin about 60% of what we do.
And for those who don't know what a Coravin is, the Coravin is a device that just came out a couple of years ago, and it enables you to extract wine from a bottle without even pulling the cork, and then it injects argon gas into the bottle, which keeps the wine pristine for a pretty prolonged period of time. And that has really opened the door for people like you to be able to do this kind of a thing, I would think.
100%. It's half of what we've been able to do. The other half is that we do about 9 wines on tap as well, which is obviously just a kegged wine, which now that the market is actually putting out really delicious juice in these kegs, it allows us to pour more wine through the glass that way as well.
I think that's a really important point to make too, because when I think people first see wine on tap, there's probably a tendency to think of it in the same way that you think of boxed wine. And actually, in reality, it kind of is. But the truth is that many, many wineries are putting out really high quality wine, and the spoilage is nil, which means, first of all, the restaurant saves quite a bit of money there, and buying it in bulk saves you quite a bit as well, does it not?
It does. Just think about it on the other side of beer. You know, it's the draft beer is cheaper for the restaurant to buy, and that savings gets passed on to the consumer. And, you know, I wouldn't think anyone would argue that beer in a bottle is better than draft beer.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So what's the highest quality kegged wine that you're seeing now?
We have a Cabernet that's out of Walla Walla Valley.
Okay.
And that sells for about $13 a glass, which is the high medium side of our glass pour prices.
And what would it sell if you had to pour it out of the bottle?
It would probably have to be somewhere around $20
wow.
a glass, just because once you open the bottle, you have to sell it that day or the next.
So you're getting 3 glasses for the price of 2.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
So the Wine by the Glass program, you can try any wine that's on the wine list. Now, can you actually try the wine, or do you have to buy a full glass? Do you offer a taste as well at a different price or different amounts of wine?
So all of our quote-unquote trophy wines, we call them, sort of a little play. It's our wines that cost over $100 by the bottle. We actually offer them by the ounce.
All right, so you can buy 1 ounce, 2 ounces, 3 ounces, probably up to 5 ounces?
Correct, 100%.
Okay, awesome. And then, as I understand it, you've organized the wine list in a different way as well. Talk about that.
So basically our wine list, we start with our tap wine, and then we go through sparkling and rosé. But we obviously keep our whites and reds separate, but we have our Blanc family vineyards, which would be your Sauvignon Blancs, your Pinot Gris, your Chenin Blancs. It's mostly by varietal, but we try to keep them in order. And then we also offer a whole section called Unique Treats, my picks from around the world of grape varietals that either most people haven't heard of or sort of areas people aren't aware of. Like we do a, you know, Sauvignon Gris has recently hit the market, and we want to be people that sort of introduce that to them.
That's awesome, too. So are people willing to experiment more now that you have this kind of wine system in place?
Yes. I think a lot of it is that we train our staff extensively on the wine. They get to taste most things. And also, either myself or my partner is on the floor every day. And we not only are willing to talk to guests, but we want to. You know, I pride myself in going to tables and teaching them about different grape varietals. And if they normally drink something, I'd like to point them in another direction. So that the next time they come in with somebody, they can be like, oh, you've never had a Mosca Filero before? So now they're the ones that are sort of the cool kids and teaching their friends and so on and so forth.
And I think what's so exciting is that by being able to buy it by the ounce, you can really go in and see what a $100 or $200 bottle of wine tastes like without having to spend $100 for the privilege. And sometimes a sip is all you need to know whether or not you are a candidate for that bottle of wine, or maybe you're happy with something that's much less expensive.
I think it definitely does that. So we just got Opus 1 in, which is obviously a huge cult wine for people, and we sell it by the ounce. And most people that I know, even my wine friends, they've never had Opus because they can't spend $400, $500 on a bottle of wine. But now you can get 2 ounces of it and have it and enjoy it.
So what do I got to pay for 2 ounces of Opus at Parallel 38 in Charlottesville?
2 ounces will cost you $36.
Ah, a bargain.
Yeah.
And then you can say, I drink Opus 1.
Exactly. Without having to be at the office Christmas party or throw down all that money.
Yeah. And awesome.
There's so many times where I've gone out myself and seen a bottle of wine that I really, really want. And, you know, you haven't really budgeted to go spend that $200, $300 on a bottle of wine. And how amazing would it be to just get 2 ounces with one of your courses?
Well, I think it's safe to say that you are going to set off a firestorm of restaurants that I think will be doing this. And I know that there are others that are taking advantage of technology like the Coravin and other preservation systems to be able to offer more really quality wines by the glass. But I think we're probably just seeing the tip of the iceberg, and especially with all the fascination that is surrounding wine and with so many people becoming somms now too. I think it's an exciting future, and I'm really excited to see restaurants like yours doing this. So congratulations.
Well, thank you very much.
And how well has this been received by the public?
It's been amazingly received. We just came in second for best wine list in town, and also we won best new restaurant just recently as well. So it's been something that I think people have really grabbed onto.
Awesome. Well, check it out. It is Parallel 38 in Charlottesville, Virginia. We're talking to Justin Ross. He's both sommelier, owner, and doing some real creative thinking, or I should say rethinking, of the wine list. So, Justin, congratulations. Wish you all the best of luck. And you've got a great website. If people want to kind of explore what's going on at the restaurant, they go to where?
It's p38seville.com.
p38seville.com. Okay, great. Hey, appreciate having you on. I really do. When we get out to the East Coast, I will definitely stop by and check it out and say hello.
All right, sounds great.
All right, take care, Justin. We'll be back with more Grape Encounters, including an introduction to somebody who is aging wine for, believe it or not, 10 years before he ever releases it. That's standard operating procedure for this winemaker. That coming up after the Grape Encounters news. Stay with us.
When life gives you lemons, you sell them for wine. Grape Encounters Radio. Grape Encounters presents What We Heard Through the Grapevine. Today's top news, trends, and stories. Here's what we've encountered. This is Grape Encounters News.
And coming up in just a couple of minutes, we're going to have a winemaker in the studio who does something that you've probably never heard of. He does not release his wines until they're at least 10 years old. Talk about a winemaker with patience. He's got an inventory of wine that dates back to the first day that he started making wine 22 years ago. It's an amazing story, so stick with us. But now it's time for the Grape Encounters news with the Galloping Gifford.
You're just giving me new nicknames, huh?
Yes, the Galloping Gifford, Larry Gifford, our chief wine news correspondent.
Why would you hold wine for 10 years?
Well, because you want it to taste good. And if you'll notice in front of you, Larry, you have a glass.
Oh, yes.
I don't normally let you drink during the news, but you have a glass of one of his wines about 10 years old. Give it a little sip.
Oh, that's really cool. It kind of sneaks into your mouth.
It sneaks into
it
your
does.
Mouth. That's what I say to my wife when there's an empty bottle in the kitchen. She goes, what happened to the wine? I go, it snuck into my mouth.
No, but then it kind of throws a party. That's really
it
cool.
It tastes totally different, doesn't it?
It does. It really is.
All right, well, we're going to hear his whole story in just a little bit. But first, what do you got for us, Larry?
E&J Gallo Winery, the world's largest family-owned winery, is out with inaugural Gallo Consumer Wine Trends Survey. They posed a series of questions to 1,001 frequent wine drinkers between the ages of 25 and 64 in order to capture the current state of Americans' wine drinking attitudes and behavior.
Okay.
And wine drinkers between the ages of 25 and 40, they're seemingly unbound by the traditions and rules that have governed wine and are unapologetically experimenting with different ways to enjoy wine.
Our kind of wine drinkers.
Yeah. So 66% of the people they surveyed mix wine with fruit or fruit juice.
Nothing wrong with that, but there are limits.
51% make a wine cocktail.
Okay.
48% mix wine with other cocktail mixers like club soda.
I wonder if these are cheap wine drinkers. Because
46% drink wine over ice.
Oh!
You've recommended that on this show.
Well, only under very, very controlled circumstances and for the right reasons, which we don't have time to talk about right now.
And here's one. You're going to have to stock up on straws, David. 27%, 1 in 4, occasionally even drink wine in a cup with a straw.
No.
Maybe it enhances their experience.
Oh, come on. Seriously?
Seriously.
These are young wine drinkers who are graduating from juice boxes. That would explain the mixing it with juice. That would explain the straws.
I'm excited that people are trying new things and they're unapologetically breaking new ground in the world of wine.
I thought that we were mavericks, but now I'm beginning to wonder.
2/3 of American wine drinkers admit to buying wine based on its label.
Well, we knew that.
However, 76% say the taste is the most important factor that will keep them coming back for more of the same bottle.
I have a sort of compromised position on that.
Oh, why is that?
When I go into a grocery store or a wine store or whatever, I taste the label.
Oh, right. Those labels all wet now.
All right.
And the most popular varietals in the U.S. are Merlot, Cabernet Sauvignon, Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, and Pinot Grigio.
I know it's not in that order, though.
No, it's that order.
No way.
Yes.
All right. Fact check. We're going to have to fact check that one. We'll talk about that next week. All right. What else you got?
Starbucks is looking to pull in foodies and wine drinkers.
I read this, and it's interesting because apparently Starbucks business may be, shall we say, lagging a little bit?
Well, their food sales are down. So they're looking to double their food sales in the next 5 years in order to draw people in the evening. They want to serve beer and wine.
Well, their food sales are down because of that spinach and feta cheese breakfast wrap.
Well, now, Starbucks locations, according to the Wall Street Journal, in Chicago, Seattle, Portland, and L.A., will sell small plates of cheese, vegetables, and flatbread pizza, along with desserts, wine, and beer after 4 o'clock.
Sounds perfect. Thank you, Starbucks. I'm still a Starbucks fan, but Starbucks, if you would just call me and confer with me on the food offerings there, I think I could help your business. And I only want 25% of the company. All right. What else you got, Larry?
Wine cork producers are doing what they can to recapture the imagination of winemakers. After 250 years of dominance, there's a ripple in the force of cork. Natural cork's global market has declined from 95% to 70% in just 10 years.
That's a lot.
So 2% of all wines now come with a screw cap. 10% use plastic corks. And that's a major wake-up call to the industry, which is primarily based in Portugal.
By the way, I am tolerant of screw caps now. If a wine's got a synthetic cork in it, it will never be purchased from me again. And I think there should be a disclosure on the bottle that says synthetic cork inside.
Oh, okay.
All right.
In response to this wake-up call, Cork Industries investing hundreds of millions of dollars in new technology and testing to address the cork taint. And they've launched a series of marketing campaigns funded by the Portuguese government.
For them.
Yeah.
Bring back the cork.
I like the cork.
I do, too.
It's romantic.
All right. What else?
During NBC's live telecast of the musical Peter Pan, pizza companies, toilet paper brands, and even wine companies were live tweeting the entertaining and often cringeworthy show. From the world of wine, it was Sutter Home Wines that got involved with the tweeting. This is what they tweeted. Faults and flaws noted, but having Captain Hook around would come in handy when it's time to uncork a bottle of Sutter Home.
Oh, so Sutter Home was capitalizing on Peter Pan.
Yeah, so they hashtagged it Sutter Home, hashtag Peter Pan Live. And it's become kind of the norm in live TV events for these brands to jump on the hashtag, like hashtag Peter Pan Live. So like DiGiorno Pizza said, delivery guys are the true Lost Boys, hashtag Peter Pan Live.
Well, you know, the one company that really jumped on the Peter Pan thing was that peanut butter company.
No, they didn't.
Well, they're Peter Pan peanut butter.
I know, and they were noticeably absent from the evening.
No!
Can you believe that?
Did they actually say that?
That's actually true. People were like, hey, where's Peter Pan peanut butter?
I wonder what pairs with peanut butter.
But Peter Pan bus line over on the East Coast got involved. And then Charmin toilet paper got involved, and he tweeted, we're patiently waiting for the booty and poop deck jokes.
All right.
And that's the news as we see it,
Dan. That's the news as it really is, because one thing about you, Larry, you're always accurate, except I have never tried having you do the news with a glass of wine in front of you.
We should do this every week.
All right. That's going to do it for the news as he says. Coming up next, that winemaker, Keith Nichols, who ages his wine a minimum of 10 years before he'll even sell it. What a story. Next on Grape Encounters Radio. Don't go anyplace.
Old red wine, well past its prime, may have to finish it after crossing the line.
And we're back with Grape Encounters Radio, and we're going to now talk about something that doesn't happen very often in the winemaking business, at least not these days. You hear about people buying wine and putting it in their cellar, and I think that that's something that mostly the rich do. But for the rest of us who can't afford to put wine away, we buy wine for instant gratification. And so a lot of winemakers now rush to get their product to market, and you'll hear winemakers say all the time, it's made to drink now. Well, my next guest is probably the most patient person that I've ever met, especially in the wine business. His name is Keith Nichols. He runs the winery of the same name, the Nichols Winery, on the central coast of California. And Keith, welcome to Grape Encounters.
Well, David, thank you very much for having me. It's great to be here.
You're the most patient person I know, because I don't think I've ever met anybody in the 6 years that I've been doing Grape Encounters anyway, who makes wine and doesn't release it for how many years?
10 years, minimum of 10 years in a combination of barrel and bottle.
So why in the world did you start doing that? Because for most people, not just wine drinkers, but winemakers, we're all looking for instant gratification. That is to say, you want to get your wine sold, right?
And, yes, of course.
And taking the chance of letting it lay down for 10 years is kind of risky business, especially at the outset when you first started making wine, right?
Yes, of course. Well, and it took me a few years to build up to that point to where I could have wines that were 10 years old in a combination of barrel and bottle. So initially, I didn't do that because I actually had to generate a little bit of revenue, but that was a goal that I wanted to accomplish, was to be able to have wines that were 10 years old in a combination of barrel and bottle, basically aging my wines for the consumer.
But I think it's safe to say that most people believe that they can lay a wine down and 10 years later it's still going to be good, but the vast majority of wines made won't last that long, will they?
Well, the key to making a wine, regardless if it's Chardonnay or Cabernet or Pinot Noir, is sourcing the fruit from the correct microclimate.
Right.
A good example is Chardonnay. So long as Chardonnay comes from a very cool climate, the fruit coming out of the vineyard will have good acid. I'm still able to take the wine through what's called 100% malolactic fermentation, a process where the malic acid is converted to lactic acid and still maintain a good acid level in the finished wine. And that's really what will allow Chardonnay to age. So sourcing fruit from the correct microclimate is key to any varietal aging for a long time.
So I had the opportunity for the first time to go over to your place. And I was shocked when I walked into your storage facility. I don't even know what to call it, actually. You had so many cases of wine. It was like a maze in that place. And it was amazing to see wines that date back how long? 22 years, right?
1992 Chardonnay, yes.
Wow. And how's that holding up?
That's holding up very well.
Yeah.
I only have a case left of that.
So. You only have a case left?
Yes.
So you have these wines that you're holding for a long time. The wine is obviously vulnerable to some degree. How do you monitor all the wines? How many different vintages are in that building?
Well, all the way from 1992 up to 2006.
But then you have all the different varietals as well. So how many unique wines are we talking about?
I probably have close to 100 different wines.
Why hang on to them that long? Is there some sort of rollout program that you have that you say, okay, in 10 years, I'm going to release this much wine, and then in 12 years, I'm going to release this much? Do you have a certain plan that you use there, or how does it work exactly?
Well, I guess there's really no scientific reason for picking a number of years. It just seems like it evolved to where I felt 10 years was a good point to release wines. So initially when I started doing that, the wines were in bottle for maybe 8 years. But now I'm actually leaving wine in barrels for 6 to 7 years before it's bottled.
That is totally amazing. And I've had some of those wines. And I have to say, it is so different to taste those wines than absolutely anything that's out there. I can't even remember seeing a wine that had been in a barrel that long. And you do it routinely.
Yes. And as you might imagine, a wine that's in barrels for 7 years, you have that slow evaporation through the oak for 7 years, losing moisture, concentrating the flavors. And I think you were very surprised when you tasted that 2006 Syrah that had been in barrels for 6 years.
Stunned.
How concentrated it was.
Yeah, stunned is the word. So are you constantly topping those barrels off, though?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's a routine every 2 weeks.
And who's actually doing that? Is that you?
No, I don't actually do
you
it.
You don't actually do it?
I have workers that do that.
Okay, I just wondered. I see you running around with the topping wine and doing all that yourself.
I have to spend time marketing the wines.
Okay, so let's talk about the marketing of the wines for a second, because that's the other thing that's really fascinating about Nichols Winery. And we are talking to Keith Nichols, the namesake of Nichols. You are pretty well known outside of the U.S. and specifically in Asia. You spent a lot of time there.
Yes.
Talk about that, and why Asia, and why do you put so much energy selling your wines so far away as opposed to marketing them right here?
Well, 15 years ago, I had an opportunity to be able to speak with someone living in Tokyo that was connected with the wine business, and it turns out I was able to sell some of my Chardonnay and Pinot Noir to them, so that gave me a foothold in Japan. So I was going there a couple times a year. And then the California Wine Institute, which organizes tastings around the world, started doing the Asian Wine Tour.
Right, yeah.
So I decided I would do that. And when you think about it, you know, you can go to Europe and try and market your wines, but Europe, they've had wines for centuries, and there's many wines there already, a saturated market. Whereas Asia is a new market, new drinkers, new wine aficionados, new people wanting to appreciate wine. So really, I think it's the place to be if you really want to grow and be able to market your wines outside of the U.S.
Well, plus in Europe, they're not buying a lot of American-made wine.
That's correct.
Yes. In fact, they're working hard not to.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Exactly. They have an aversion to it. But in Asia, they're completely open to it.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, in fact, they're trying hungry. To buy up everything that they can get, actually.
Yes. And there's a number of people there in some Asian countries that still don't understand wine, but they're part of the elite now or are very successful, have money. So what they do is they buy wine to gift to someone else. And what that says is, I've made it. I can buy wine. I can give it to you. So I'm successful.
There was a documentary called The Red Invasion. Have you seen that movie?
No, I have not.
Okay, you'll need to see that. But the gist of at least part of that documentary is the idea that a lot of the Asian wine collectors never even open the bottles.
Oh, yes. That's
Have you found that to be the case when you're there?
Yes, that's true, yes.
So how many of your wines never get open, do you think? Or are your wines more drinkable?
Well, my wines are more drinkable because I age them so long. However, I'm finding even across the U.S. from time to time, I'm getting calls from people saying, oh, I was just given a bottle of your wine from a cellar of a friend of mine who's had it for some time, and I just wanted to call you and see what you have to say about it, and that it's 12, 15 years old. Is it still drinkable? And it's interesting when they call me because I'm able to tell them, well, I've drank some of that within the last 6 months, and yes, wine is fine. It's beautiful.
Last week, we had on Paul Draper, the winemaker from Ridge Vineyards, and of course, he was in the original Judgment of Paris back in 1976, and then they had a rematch decades later, and the wines in the rematch were the same wines that were in the original contest in 1976, and he went on to win that rematch decades later. Those wines weren't fazed by time.
No, and I recall that, and that's a good example of how California wines will age.
So I had the opportunity some years back to spend some time on the island of Madeira, and that's an interesting world there because when they make those Madeira wines, of course, they're fortified wines, so they last almost indefinitely. But they plan on keeping those wines around for hundreds of years, literally. And it's not unusual to go over there and buy a 200-year-old bottle of Madeira wine. But I think that in our culture, we don't think long-term like that. And it's kind of unusual and refreshing to see somebody that actually does that.
Yes, yes, absolutely. You know, I think there's many consumers out there that appreciate someone that's aging their wine for some time. And the other thing I might mention is that I bottle all of my reds unfiltered, unvined. And interestingly enough, I'm finding that actually the color will deepen over years because there's still some small, very minute particles.
The particulate matter in there, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And that's continuing to contribute to the color evolution, the flavor evolution of the wine. And it's amazing how over time the wine just changes. And I wished everybody could experience, as I get to, tasting a wine right after it's bottled. And then when it's in bottle 1 year, 2 years, all the way up through 10 years, it's marvelous how the wine evolves. It's so exciting.
All right. So this is a difficult question to ask. You seem to be somebody who's in very good health, but eventually you're going to get older.
Yes, everybody does. Yes.
Yeah. And one of these days you'll be in your, you know, like some of these winemakers, you know, who are in their 90s and still going strong. What happens with all this wine as you get older and you don't want to manage this massive amount of inventory that you have? Or do you pass it along to somebody in your family? What happens at that point?
Well, yes, I have two daughters, one of which was interested in making wine. In fact, she made wine under her own brand called Vindel. And my younger daughter, who does not work in the wine business, but she has a expertise in retail. So I think likewise, she can carry on as well. By virtue of just being around me all the time, she now knows a lot about wine, appreciates great wine, so it's not a problem. Somebody's going to carry it on.
How many cases are you sitting on right now?
33,000 cases.
33,000 cases.
Yes.
I mean, in the grand scheme of things, if you were a winery that was turning your wine every year, that's not a huge number.
No.
Not at all. But from the standpoint of those wines being old wines, that's a lot of old wine.
Yes. And a lot of wine for a boutique winery as well.
That's a lot of wine, yes.
Yes.
How much wine do you make each year?
Well, it varies. The least amount was 3,000 cases, and the most amount I made in 1 year was, fortunately, in 1997, I made 15,000 cases, and what a wonderful year 1997 was for wine.
So if you made the right phone call to China or Japan or Korea, could you unload all the wine in one fell swoop?
I would not want to.
Oh, I'm just asking.
You can't believe if somebody buys one case of wine, I feel so bad because it's leaving me.
Seriously?
Yes.
You pine over a case that's sold?
I do.
Well, I bought several cases from you. And
I
you
cried
didn't, you
afterwards.
Didn't, you shed a tear?
After you left, I cried.
You did, actually.
No,
I don't
didn't,
believe you.
I didn't. But I do experience that. It's like my children are leaving me.
Let's talk about art for a second. You're an artist.
Well, I don't know if I'm an artist.
But you create a lot of the art that's on your own bottles, right?
Well, yes. What happened was when I started making wine, I had a graphic artist and an artist design my label, and she painted the art for the first two labels, which was a Nickel Chardonnay from Tally Vineyards and a Pinot Noir from Sierra Madre Vineyard. And after that first bottling, I had seven additional wines that I was going to be bottling the next year, and I wanted to have a different piece of art for each wine. So I went out and started buying art and started mocking it up within my graphic design, and the art I was buying just wasn't working on the label. So over Thanksgiving and Christmas 1 year, I decided I'll go buy a book on color and just started painting. And at first, I was trying to instruct my hand to go where on the canvas I wanted it to, and the art was horrible. Finally, when I just let my hand go by itself and didn't try and direct it, then everything started flowing and the art worked. And each time I was painting a piece of art, I had a specific wine in mind, meaning Pinot Noir or a Cabernet Sauvignon or a Chardonnay. So the art I was painting while in my mind the exact wine that it was going to be going on.
So there's a strong connection between the art and what's in the bottle.
That's correct.
And your hand just paints.
Yeah, I just let my hand go where it wants to, and it ends up putting paint on a canvas, which is very abstract and works.
That's kind of creepy, Keith. That's kind of strange. All right, we'll be back in a flash with my guest, Keith Nichols of Nichols Winery. You know, when you've got tens of thousands of cases of wine with decades of age on them, it takes more than luck to ensure they'll taste perfect when they finally get uncorked. We'll find out if Keith ever gets a little nervous about that little reality after this. With Grape Encounters Radio, my guest is Keith Nichols of Nichols Winery in California. Keith is pretty unique in the winemaking world because he won't even release a wine until it's at least 10 years old. That might as well be a lifetime in human years. So, Keith, how many times in the past have you gone to wines that have been in the cellar for a long time and discovered wines that did not hold up?
Actually, generally what happens is that if you open a bottle of wine and it appears that it's not holding up, if you go and open another bottle of the same wine, then you find that it's okay. So I guess the one downside of aging wines for an extended period of time is now and then you will find a bottle that just hasn't held up for whatever reason. Maybe it was the cork that was in the bottle. But in general, they all are marvelous. Recently, I've opened some of my 1996 Chardonnays, and my 96 Chardonnay from Tally Vineyards, when I open that bottle, it tastes and smells just like lemon meringue pie.
It tastes like lemon meringue pie?
Yes.
Okay. That's weird, too.
Well, I guess it is. But, you know, when you think about it, every when we smell and taste a wine, there's many flavors that we're getting there, and it just some come forward at different times in the evolution of wine.
I don't think I've ever heard lemon meringue pie in tasting notes before. Well, I guess so.
Well, it takes 10 years or more for wine to age to get to the lemon meringue pie. flavor.
So is it risky business when you're selling wines this old? And as you said, once in a while, you'll have a bottle in the batch that's not holding up as well as others. And who knows why that even happens? You know, they're all going down the same bottling line, using the same corks, came out of the same barrel, et cetera. But every once in a while, there's going to be one that's
yes.
not holding up well. How many times do you get a call, or do you get calls from time to time from somebody who's purchased the wines and said, oops, got a bad bottle here, Keith?
It's interesting that people that really know wine and they are wine aficionados and they're buying my wine from Nichols Winery, a library wine, may be 15 to 20 years old, not 10 years old. So I have this one gentleman in New Jersey who buys my library wines all the time. And he's told me many times, he says, Keith, he says, I understand when I buy cases of wine from you, because they're older wines, I know there's going to be one or two bottles that are not going to be right. But I understand that. And he doesn't even expect me to replace it, but I still will do that for him. Whereas someone who doesn't know a lot about wine and they want to try a wine that's been in bottle for 10 or 15 years, those are the people that will call you and want to bottle replaced. And I don't have a problem with that at all.
Part of the cost of doing business.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, and that's for the person who's buying the wine as well, is what comes with the reward of being able to buy wines that are that old is that sometimes there's going to be a little spoilage.
Yes. You know, the other interesting thing about having wines that are so old, I've got calls from people that had some significant event that happened in, say, 1995. And in 1998, either they met their girlfriend, now wife, in 1995, 1998, they got married. They're able to call me and say, Keith, do you have any wines from 1995 or 98? I say, of course I do. So they buy a significant amount of that wine.
That's a very interesting thought.
It's a very good year for them, and they want to be able to sit down and have a nice romantic evening and drink wines from the year they met, the year they got married.
It's so fascinating to think about wine as living history. And the idea that wine has seen so many things happen, you know, as
yes.
time goes on. And I think you and I talked about this the last time we were together, going back to those Madeiras. You know, many of those wines were made before there was electricity, before there were automobiles, let alone planes. And yet, you know, that wine sat there beautiful and pristine
yes.
and survived generation after generation of family members that served as guardians to that wine.
Yes.
It's an amazing thought when you think about it, and amazing to think about what your wines have lived through, you know,
yes.
to get to, I mean, 22 years is a long time.
It is. Yes, it does seem like a long time.
You know, 22, I'd like to be 22 years younger.
Yeah, me too.
Well, Keith, very nice talking to you today. It's such a fascinating business that you're running. Do you know anybody else that's doing what you're doing? You know, I can't honestly say that I've come across anybody that is intentionally aging wine for that length of time. I mean, certainly there are lots of winemakers that make wines that will hold up and that are, you know, wines that are collectible and will lay down. But to do it on purpose with all of your wine, that's a very different story.
Yeah, I don't really know anyone else that's doing it. And fortunately, I don't have any partners, so I don't have to ask anybody or get approval to do that. It was something I wanted to do, so I did it. And I'm having so much fun getting to experience these wines over 10, 15, 20 years. It's just a joy to experience them as they age.
If I went into your cellar and I randomly grabbed a bottle and poured it blind into a glass for you, could you tell me what it was?
I could tell you the varietal. If you're asking me if I could tell what year it was, no, probably not.
All right. I was curious about that.
Oh, okay.
How well you really know your children.
Oh, okay. Well, I have too many children to know them all really, really well.
All right. Well, Keith Nichols has been my guest. It's Nichols Winery. You can find them online at nicholswinery.com. It's N-I-C-H-O-L-S winery.com. And you'll ship wine wherever they are, right?
Wherever they want it shipped to, I'll ship it, yes.
It's a great experience. And if you get a chance and you're hearing this, just reach out to Keith and get a bottle. and try it. It's going to be something very different than you've ever experienced before, wine that's been sitting this long. The most patient winemaker I think I've ever met in my life. That's you.
Yes. Well, thank you. Or actually, these people could bring a group, and they could have a library wine tasting for 8 or 10 people.
In the upside down cellar.
In the upside down wine cellar, yes. And they can select the wines.
And what you mean by that is the cellar is upstairs, not downstairs.
Correct.
It's in the rafters.
It's a cellar that's upstairs from the downstairs cellar. Yes,
and
in the rafters.
And what's very interesting about the upside-down cellar is the walls are all cases of wine.
Randomly,
yeah.
Placed.
Cattywampus.
A treasure hunt.
All righty then. That's a wrap for this edition of Grape Encounters Radio. I think it's time to uncork something really fine. Gee, I wonder where I can get something with a little age on it. We'll talk to you next week.
You never know what part of the country or the world the Grape Encounters microphones will take you to. Don't miss a single experience. Your Grape Encounter isn't over. We're just taking a breather until next week's edition.